You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. Maximize your effectiveness in the changing global business environment with the postgraduate Oxford Diploma in Global Business. Taught in four short modules over a year, the program is designed to accelerate your career and increase your impact while minimizing the disruption to your work and family life. Learn alongside senior executives from around the world and develop a lifelong network. Visit the Oxford Diploma in Global Business website to find out more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast episode 48. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today I'm in conversation with Diane Coyle, who is a Professor of Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. Diane was previously Professor of Economics at the University of Manchester and has held a number of public service roles, including Vice Chair of the BBC Trust, Member of the Competition Commission, and Member of the Migration Advisory Committee. As always, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, Diane Coyle, thank you very much indeed for taking the time this morning to talk to me about technology, what technology means for economic policy, public policy, and also economics as an academic discipline. And let me get going with one of the quotes that I found from you that struck me. So you made the argument that all technology is social. Could you maybe explain what exactly you mean by this?
There's a lot of debate about the future of technology in terms of the effects on jobs or the structure of markets and digital giants and so on, that seems to take it for granted that the path of the technology is determined. So there's a lot of technological determinism about it. And yet the way that technology gets used, diffused through society, even actually what gets invented in the first place, the direction of innovation in the first place, they're all shaped by economic and social factors, whether that's something as kind of hard-edged as financial incentives and the relative price of different factors of production, or whether it's social norms and the culture in which the technology is being used. My favourite example is actually electricity, because this is a late 19th century technology. It's been in widespread use in many countries since the early 20th century. And yet there are still many parts of the world where it isn't possible for the electricity companies to provide a consistent supply. And that tells me that because of the characters of the product and the technology and the complexity of the structures, actually the social aspects of that are really, really important. I'll play it forward now and into the debate about automation and jobs. And you find people making some quite extreme predictions about job losses due to automation and AI. And, of course, we know that we didn't deal well with the kind of job losses in the early 1980s or early 1990s that came about through automation. So the policy challenge is very real. But the idea that it's inevitable seems to me obviously untrue, because if you look back at different types of technology, the Industrial Revolution wave and the Second Industrial Revolution wave in the early 20th century, they had completely different social effects. The Industrial Revolution gave us great inequality and social upheaval, and the 20th century innovations gave us a much more socially fair diffusion and use of technology and improvements in living standards across the board. Nobody's asking why they were different, and that's the kind of question I'm interested in.
So basically what you're saying is that we should have actually a social and societal argument about technology, because first of all, what is being developed is socially determined to a large extent, and even if it is developed, how it is disseminated is also very much a function of, you know, what society allows to be disseminated.
That's absolutely right. And the first point about what gets developed, you can see playing out right now in two key technologies. One is in AI. Why is it that the first applications of AI are in criminal justice and policing and facial surveillance? There's nothing about the technology that has predetermined that. Similarly, in biomedicine, we know that the kind of market structures that we have encourage the innovation of products that will produce a stream of revenue serving affluent markets. And so rare diseases, low-income markets, one-off interventions are underfunded by the private market. It's kind of economics 101. But we ought to be asking in terms of policy and society why we're allowing that to happen.
So, and if we come to the effects of digital technology that we see in unfolding already in the real economy, you made a really interesting argument the other day at the Oxford Martin School. How do you see digital technology change competition? And you made a very important point, I think, when you say that. I think you quoted Hal Varian from Google that, you know, in many digital markets, it's not competition in the market, but it's actually competition for the market. Could you dwell on this a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the insight dates back to the economist Will Bammel, who coined these phrases in competition in the market and for the market. And yet we've had a competition approach to competition policy that thinks about competition at one moment in time, competition in the market. But in any market, whether it's a classic natural monopoly like electricity or railways, or a new quasi-natural monopoly like a digital market, where there are very, very large economies of scale and increasing returns and network effects, then competition is going to be that you get a dominant player or perhaps two at any moment in time, but the market needs to be contestable. It needs to be possible to replace them with somebody else. And so competition policy needs to focus on the conditions for making that possible. And although the theory's been there for a while in economics, the sort of practical tools that policymakers need to understand how do they do that, how do they evaluate the scope for new entrants to come into the market, that hasn't been in place. And it's something that is just starting to be thought about.
And that's a very interesting point because, as you rightly said, sort of the standard economic thinking is a cross section, any given point in time, and you analyze the market structure. But this seems to be an era of time, so where you have an absolute dominant player that could be replaced at some point in the future rather than today. And how do you see that? You know, obviously you mentioned natural monopolies, and standard economics would say there's an increased obvious role for regulation in natural monopolies, given that you have, in a sense, if I understand you correctly, time limited natural monopolies in these markets. Would you also see that regulation ought to play a bigger role in this?
Yes, I don't think competition and regulation are entirely alternatives, and there will be some things that we want to regulate, and in particular, regulation that makes that kind of sequential competition possible. So in the digital context, that would include, for example, regulation about technical standards for data and interoperability of services, so that it's possible for new entrants to access the kind of data that give the incumbents their advantage. There's an argument that there is a feedback loop whereby the incumbents like Google and Facebook already have so much data on their users that they can develop better products, get more users, get even better data, and so they build themselves a positive feedback loop. How does anybody else break into that? Well, partly it might be that that data is accessible because the technical standards and the metadata and the formats are standardized so much. And that's clearly, I think, a role for regulators to play. So regulation can be pro-competitive and I think ought to be charged with being pro-competitive.
And I've heard the argument in recent research that this situation could even stifle innovation because the incumbents don't necessarily need to innovate to stay ahead of the game because they have this natural advantage. And for the potential competition, the marginal cost of competing is so high because exactly at the moment they do not have access to the raw material they need, i.e. the data, in order to innovate. So it's a rather rigid structure.
I think there's a really interesting phenomenon at the moment whereby you see a company like Facebook maybe degrading their own product so much that maybe that's going to incentivize their users to switch to something else. And they themselves have to strike this balance between making it so unattractive that users want to leave them and taking advantage of the kind of data acquisition that they have in place to create ever more profit for themselves.
And a second point related to this is obviously not just how players dominate one particular market, but how they use the network effects of their data to move into completely different sectors. And one of the things that struck me is that if you look at, say, the expansion of Amazon as an example, I mean, you could see how it would be a natural progression from an online bookseller to sell other things and maybe even go into logistics. But, you know, how they became the dominant player in cloud computing, producing voice-enabled speakers, and are now apparently looking into a health insurance market in the United States, because this is a very big market and largely undisrupted. So there seems to be a sort of anarchic expansion. It's certainly not linear as you used to think about expansion of a certain business. So how would you analyze this?
The technical term for this in the literature is envelopment, that once you have a group of users in one market, you can use that users to get yourself into another market. And another example would be Uber as a transportation company, but then it gets into Uber Eats, into food delivery, because it's got a very large user base. There's a competition policy challenge there, because we're used to analyzing specific markets, the market definition. And obviously, these are companies leveraging their great size into other markets. So as the competition regulator, where do you draw the boundaries on what you ought to be investigating? So Amazon is a really interesting example. It's a great service. It's fantastic for its users. It delivers great prices, great services, convenience, timeliness, you know, all of those things. And what it's done over the years is actually not take out profits, but invest a lot of its revenue in building all of these other services, building the data centers for its cloud business and so on. And so one question I think is, what's the consumer detriment? What exactly are you worried about that they're doing to harm their consumers? And there are some obvious things that aren't being tackled. We get loads of deliveries from Amazon. They create loads of packaging. Local authorities have to pay to remove that. There are environmental costs. So it seems to me there are clearly some, there's an externality there that one should tax. One should tax the use of packaging, perhaps, or the use of delivery vehicles more, and so on. But on your kind of wider question about, do we worry about their growing power? Do we worry about them going into health insurance? Well, I'm not sure I do, because that market in the US clearly does need disrupting. It serves people really badly. If Amazon goes into it, that would probably be very good for consumers. If you worry about their power, then that takes me back to the data point, that you want it to be possible for anybody to break into that market and offer a better insurance product, because they can access customer data in a standard format using APIs. And one model is the open banking model in the United Kingdom. I'm not sure how well it's actually working in practice, but that's the thought behind it, that you create APIs for anybody to be able to access the customer data and build products and services to offer. We don't know whether it will work. I think it's worth trying though.
And I'm not necessarily arguing that, you know, they shouldn't disrupt the insurance market, but it's, as you say, it's a question of Amazon, I think, is a very good example, because, as you rightly said, they never sort of paid any money to their shareholders. They reinvested their profits for decades into aggressive expansion in pretty much all areas they could really think of. So that's why I like this as a prime example where, you know, the sole focus has been really from a business strategy point of view on expansion. But, you know, what does this mean in accumulated power for one particular company if it is dominant in so many different and most people would say probably unrelated markets? You know, how does that work? And can you really democratize the potential of being you know, displaced by competition, by interoperability, and making data accessible? That's certainly one starting point. But you mentioned general problems for competition policy and probably also for antitrust regulation. So apart from the data aspect that you've already mentioned, where would you see the biggest challenges for competition policy and antitrust regulation in the face of these developments?
Well, I don't know how much I worry just about the sheer size of the companies, which many people do. I mean, of course, they're large and powerful. We've got a lot of large and powerful companies, though. Why should I worry about Google and Amazon more than I worry about the big banks or the big oil companies? So to focus this just on digital, I think, is wrong. There's a more general size problem and problem of, particularly in the United States, the role of finance in political campaigns. So I think it's broader than that. And the other bit of the challenge is then about regulation, because, you know, you're absolutely right in alluding to the fact that competition policy, antitrust policy can't fix all of this. And there needs to be regulation too. So if we are concerned that Amazon and Microsoft and Google are the three companies that are building the data centers that have become part of critical national infrastructure, you're not going to easily open that to competition because they're very large capital investments and the incumbents have a big advantage. So then you have to play regulation into it as well. And then the challenge that we haven't yet worked through is what kind of regulation works for nation states against global companies with all of these cross-border flows of data occurring. We're not even measuring the cross-border flows of data properly. We don't know actually what's happening, what the implications are for trade figures. We don't have any consensus on international tax frameworks for these very large companies, digital or otherwise. So there's a long, long way to go, I think, in global economic governance for these kinds of market structures.
And you make an important point, and but I should stress, it's not about just picking on specific companies in the technology sector. I agree with you that this is a much more general problem. You can see this in the area of taxation. I mean, we have digital companies, but also to a large extent, digitizing companies, you know, where traditional industries are becoming more and more digital, and you will have the same problems there that you now see in, let's call them maybe purely digital companies. And some of the, for instance, taxation challenges have nothing to do with the technology itself, but more with the move of the economy towards more immaterial assets. I mean, how you price the use of brands and these sort of things. I mean, transfer pricing and, you know, these are not necessarily digital questions. So we have, as far as I can see, these two things coming together, and the taxation model is breaking down as a result of this.
Yeah, and this has been happening over a very long time, and actually it's all large companies. If you look at the accounts of a supermarket chain or any other retailer, you'll find that they've got complex tax structures going through low-tax entities like the British Virgin Islands. So this is across the economy, and it's come about because of a change over several decades in, if you like, the norms of acceptability of corporate behaviour. If a government really wanted to do something about it, it could say it would not procure any products or services from companies with complex tax structures.
Yeah.
That would do it.
Well, given the volume of government procurement, that would definitely be a good starting point. I mean, let's come, because you're a professor of public policy at the end of the day, and we are particularly interested in the public policy implications of this. And yeah, I mean, the first thing is, as you rightly say, I think to identify that this is not just about digital companies. There's a much wider spread problem. And given that technology is in all sorts of sectors becoming more important in the future, no matter whether you are a native digital company or a more traditional company that is effectively forced to introduce more and more of those technologies, these problems are likely to become more widespread, aren't they?
I think so. I mean, in a way, it'll become silly to talk about the digital economy. It'll be like talking about the electricity economy, because everything is digitizing. And, you know, I think the challenge is really about norms of corporate behavior that have evolved over time. And so it's the whole structure of corporate governance, the whole structure of what's acceptable in terms of taxation, corporate remuneration. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it would have been unthinkable for chief executives to receive incomes in the millions and many hundreds of times the median that they pay people in their companies. So that norm kind of broke down because of the, I guess, the broader changes in the climate of ideas and politics. And I do think the climate of ideas is now changing, that the sense that you just leave it to the market and the state are in opposition, you've got to get the state out of the way, that whole Reagan-Thatcher construct is intellectually breaking down, but that is not yet being reflected in the world of policy. And actually, as you know, we've been discussing already, there's a whole range of areas of policy that you need to tackle to reshape this relationship between business and business and people.
And you also made the point that I think is very important, that you know, a lot of the policymakers or the people who are developing policies were taught in economics, and they're obviously, you mentioned theoretical as well as conceptual and empirical problems with economics as it's been taught, which leads into some of these policy problems. Could you maybe elaborate on this? What do you mean exactly by this?
Yeah, the number of economists working in government has gone up steadily over the years. I only have the figures for the UK, but it's true everywhere that economics has become the dominant profession in government. And a lot of the people who are now doing that work have been taught economics in universities at a time when the curriculum reflected that particular intellectual framework, you know, quite reductionist, individualist, and the idea that there's an opposition between market and state, and that the state steps in only when there's a very clearly identified market failure. I think the academic profession and the frontier of ideas in economics has really changed quite dramatically since then. And if you think about behavioral economics, market design, institutional, the importance of institutional economics, economic history, all of those have completely turned the tide on how you would think about the economy. That's starting to change in the curriculum as well. So the what students are taught now is starting to change very much as well. But the whole cohort of economists working in policy, working in financial markets, are still in the old mental framework. And I do find that when I go and talk to officials about a coordination problem, where you want to get a whole number of private sector businesses to align on a new standard. So let me give you an example. There's a campaign here called Close the Door, which tries to persuade shops to close their store doors during the winter rather than leave them open and have heat blasting down. So it's an environmental campaign. And none of the stores want to do it because individually, if they're the only one that does it, they lose the impulse shoppers and they go to the store next door. And so it needs the government to say, you've got to close your door in the winter. And it's a very simple coordination intervention. It's free, doesn't cost the government anything. And trying to explain to officials that this is a coordination problem that only official intervention can solve is a really uphill struggle and obviously hasn't worked. But there are loads of that kind of coordination problem where the government's action can shape the market and help it grow and help businesses. And it's not difficult economics, it's very basic stuff. And it's just quite hard to get that kind of message through.
Hmm. And if you come to the sort of potential solutions to all of these problems, I mean, would you agree that, you know, especially as a starting point, public discourse is not really where it should be? I mean, there is always the idea, or if you read the international media, whether it's in the UK or in Germany, it's pretty much always the same, that your helplessness in the face of what is going to come down to you. That reminds me very much of the sort of globalization debate. It's something exogenous, it's something that is happening to you. You have to adjust, there's nothing you can do about it. Rather than seeing this, look, okay, there is a transformation happening. But the way it happens, there's a societal role, there's a policy role for shaping this. So accepting this power of shaping this and having a discussion with all the relevant stakeholders in the game, government, civil society, companies, about, you know, what the direction should be. I don't really see this. Do you share this, or have different insights?
I agree with you, and I get very frustrated because there's a lot of criticism of economics, and it's kind of out of date criticism. So it attacks academic economists like myself on grounds that might have been true 30 years ago, but are really not true now. And then it misses the things for which you could properly criticize the profession. Or it misses the distinction between what academics say or what, you know, what economics says and what actually happens in policy practice. So we could have a much richer discussion that would drive things forward, as you're suggesting. But one of the useful things about the discussion of digital is that actually it is possible to have a more constructive debate in this domain, because everybody agrees that something has to be done and will be done. So rather than having to argue about should we, shouldn't we in the first place, everybody says, yes, we should do something. Now let's talk in detail about what would be effective and what we want the outcomes to be.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you're trying to launch to an extent here in Germany is the fact that obviously there's a lot of discussion about what the effect of technology on labor markets might be. And depending on how you model it, you'll get completely different results. There is no consensus. But where there seems to be consensus is that the type of tasks that will determine the work of the future will be much more based on social competence, on problem-solving capacity, and on creativity. So there seems to be consensus on that. But ergo, in terms of public policy, that means these are the transformative parts of work. And if you deploy work as an intelligently throughout society, you can actually use it as a transformative tool. So if you use that, for instance, demographic change is a huge problem, and particularly in Germany also. So if you incentivize certain types of social work in a way that leverages this, social competence aspect, the creativity aspect, you can actually have a significant improvement. So you can understand this, that, you know, the fact that work is gonna focus much less on routine tasks and much more on these potentially transformative elements. You can use that throughout society to improve the lives of people. So I think these are one of the ways that policymakers could maybe start think of, you know, new levers in a way.
In the long run, the changes in the character of work ought to be a great thing. I grew up in a cotton town in Lancashire, and a lot of my family worked in cotton mills. They're pretty horrible jobs, and I'm glad that they got automated out of existence. So there's a real prize to be gained from this transformation of the workplace. I worry that we are not remotely training people to be able to perform that kind of work. Particularly in the UK, but I think in a number of other countries too, we are not teaching problem solving and creativity and critical thinking in schools. So that's a big transformation that needs to take place. And then the other aspect is for people who are already working, how do we start to think about the organisation of the skills that they need and the work that they will do and the reward structures for doing that work? Particularly because we deliver a lot of social policy through companies, and actually the amount of that delivery has increased. And yet you're talking about a workplace where many people will not work for companies. Already here we have a quarter of the workforce not in standard employment contracts. And so using companies to deliver the social contract and social policy is not going to be sustainable. So that's another big transformation that I would say needs to take place.
Yeah, and you make a very important point. I mean, the educational system is still not geared towards teaching the core competencies, but much more, it's still much more about memorizing state-of-the-art knowledge that might be obsolete or outdated in 5 years' time.
The dates of battles and quotations from novels and things that are, you know, really good to know and good mental discipline, but won't equip you for the workplace of the future.
Well, absolutely. And towards the end of this, let me ask you the same question that I ask pretty much all people that are part of the show. If you were a policymaker, given the set of challenges that we've just talked about, what would your top three priorities be? Where would you start to introduce policy change, and what kind of change would you like to see in the position 1 to 3?
So I think it's very hard for the government to fix everything itself. And I would put the emphasis on equipping people with the agency they need to determine their own futures. So one would be the education system and changing that to equip people with the opportunity through their lives to get the training that they need. One would be about access to basic infrastructure, basic travel, broadband at high quality and good prices. So, you know, education and health on the one hand, physical infrastructure on the other hand. So that has to be improved. And then the third is housing, actually, because it's one of the basics. And if you're not delivering a decent place to live, the state is failing.
And do you see a connection between, you know, the move towards conurbation area and sort of the disempowerment of rural areas? So would you accept this as, you know, something that is just happening, or would you have a special program to sort of improve access and connection of rural areas that seem to be difficult?
Yeah, this seems to be a big challenge everywhere. You know, our term for it is left behind places. And it's clear that the forces of agglomeration in the modern economy have been very strong. So urbanization has always gone hand in hand with economic development. And if anything, that's accelerating now. And I think people make a choice. You know, either you want to go into the urban area for the opportunity, or you want to stay in a more remote area for the quality of life or different reasons. But there needs to be a sort of basic minimum. And some places have fallen below that basic minimum in terms of connectivity or basic public services. So I would see it as a kind of minimum offer, which has not been delivered everywhere in recent times.
Well, lots of challenges ahead. Diane Cole, thank you very much indeed again for taking the time to talk to me this morning.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.